So I'm drunk at the dinner table at Mother and Dad's house in Maine. And my brothers and sister are there, Laura's there, and I'm sitting next to a beautiful woman, friend of Mother and Dad's. And I said to her out loud, "What is sex like after 50?
Silence.
I mean, total silence. And not only silence, but like serious daggers.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And that, of course, was our 43rd President of the United States, George W. Bush, recalling one of the unfortunate incidents that befell him when he was still drinking.
Wait a second. That was not a parody. That was actually former President Bush?
Matt Lauer interviewed the former president on NBC. In fact, the former president has been all over the media in the last week or two promoting his new book, Decision Points. And what did you think of Decision Points?
Well, I'm waiting for the movie to come out, but what I have read, and I have not seen all the interviews, but I thought that he was more introspective than I expected from him, because as I recall, during those wonderful 8 years, some of them were wonderful, some were not, but during those 8 years, for the most...
I'm just taking quick notes here. Which were the wonderful years?
1963, 1066, and 1492.
All right. None of which fell within the presidency of George W. Bush.
Go figure. Anyway, the fact that he regret about Katrina and how he looked kind of elitist by looking at New Orleans from Air Force One, that was interesting. His musings about whether to pardon Scooter Libby or
not. Yes, the whole conflict with Dick Cheney.
Right, and Cheney offered to resign or at least leave the ticket in 2004. And, again, for somebody who, remember, he was always the cowboy who always was right and never gave it a second thought, I thought there was more introspection from Mr. Bush than I expected.
Yes, he actually seems quite thoughtful on some of these points. Now, whether or not he's satisfying his critics, of course, totally another question. It's not going to make anyone like his policy on waterboarding anymore just to find out that he's acknowledging openly that he approved the waterboarding himself. But at least you could say that he seems to be in some degree, in some form, coming to grips with the experience of his presidency and everything that it has wrought.
You know, there is a caricature, there's a cartoon image of President Bush, much of which is unfair and perhaps much of which is deserved. But again, I thought he addressed it and I thought he was aware of what everybody was saying.
Yes. All right. We have another president now, and this president has spent the past week traveling, most of it, in Indonesia, India, and Korea. He has not brought home the sort of trophies he was hoping to bring home.
You mean like a Democratic victory in the House?
Well, like a South Korean trade agreement or something from India besides these deals that were so clearly already negotiated before he went. I suppose this is what trips that presidents take are going to be like in contemporary world affairs. The president's not going to come back with a surprise agreement with somebody, and probably there wouldn't be a lot of approval for it if he did. But at least he seems to have kept to a minimum those unfortunate moments that seem to happen when presidents travel abroad and that hurt them back home. I mean, in a sense, what could happen right now that would compare to what he's been through in terms of the political shellacking?
But I just wondered if the foreign view of President Obama is on the same course as the way it is in this country, that he's a diminished president.
I think actually there's been a certain amount of reaction around the world since that election of people saying, those Americans, we were amazed that they elected Barack Obama in the first place, but now they're going back to the Republicans. They're reverting to the behavior that we came to expect from them. So we've seen a certain amount of that sort of anti-American sentiment expressed in Europe and other parts of the world. It is interesting to me, though, that this particular trip is concentrating the president's attention on a part of the world that we have not spent much time on, certainly not since the Vietnam War, South Asia, the parts of Asia that we don't talk about so much, certainly Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim country, and yet most people in this country aren't even aware that it is a Muslim country.
And as you say, one of the countries that we know so little about, and this is an opportunity to, if President Obama's one of his goals from the beginning is to reach out to the Muslim world, where a better place than a country like Indonesia?
Absolutely. So in many respects, this is the kind of trip that you would expect a president like Barack Obama, somebody who wants to be a globalist president, to take and to have well received in the countries he's gone to, and it certainly has been in the countries that he's gone to. The only question is, for the purposes of this podcast, how's it playing at home? How's it playing back home, Ken?
Well, actually, I've just been abroad, and I've just been to Palm Beach and DeKalb, Illinois, and Cleveland, Illinois, and Palm Beach, Illinois. And what I found is that Democrats are still reeling about Tuesday's elections.
So the shellacking goes on, and
it does
continues to resonate, and they're not really thinking. I mean, to some degree, to some degree, we had observed earlier that maybe it wasn't the world's greatest thing for the president to head for Indonesia right after the midterm election. But to some degree, now in retrospect, it looks like it was almost a godsend for him to just get out of the country.
Plus, the presidency,
focus on something
else. The presidency
else.
Goes on. He's still president. Exactly. He's not the election president.
That's
he's the president, right?
Foreign policy. Go do something else for a little while. Gather your thoughts. See the old haunts back there in Indonesia. See some of the old school chums.
But coming back from those three states, Florida, Illinois, and Ohio, three states which are very emblematic of what happened on November 2nd.
Absolutely.
Huge Republican victories. Florida, Alex Sink losing to Rick Scott for the governorship. Many members of Congress going down. Ohio, a clean sweep.
Five
for the Republicans.
House seats. Down.
And every statewide office, including, of course, the Senate seat and the governorship. Mm-hmm. And Illinois as well, even though the Democrats barely retained the governorship in Illinois, but Mark Kirk won President Obama's Senate seat. And many members of Congress, Debbie Harverson, Lane Evans, and Bill Foster, all defeated, but there are still some races have yet to be called.
So you have been out there to the scenes of the devastation.
Or the jubilation, depending on your point of view, of course.
But you're talking about Democrats.
Right.
So the devastation of the Democrats, they're not worried about where the president is right now, and they're not worried about particularly how many jobs he can bring back from India and Korea. Right now, they're just worrying about all of the races that they've lost themselves. And the devastation, by the way, is not over. Mm. There are still a number of question marks out there. Alaska, that's already a Republican seat. We're just trying to decide which Republican, whether it's going to be Joe Miller, whose name was on the ballot and got 34-35% of the vote, or perhaps Lisa Murkowski, if in fact the 40% of the vote that was write-in was all for her.
Yes, but there's a tremendous difference which Republican wins, because Joe Miller is a Tea Party, no-compromise kind of Republican, as many Tea Party candidates were, whereas Lisa Murkowski said if she's returned to the Senate, she will continue to reach across party lines, and this is exactly not the message that Tea Party folks ran on in 2010 or hope to see in the 2011 in the next Congress. So, I mean, right now it looks like Murkowski does win, but of course there'll be a court challenge. Joe Miller says that
they got to all spell her name right.
If you spell Murkowski wrong, if you say Lisa Murkowski with a Y or anything like that, we have no right to decide voter intent.
I think it's slightly ironic that the Leave Us Alone Here in Alaska candidate Joe Miller has as his first act after the election suing in federal court against the state of Alaska.
Reminds me of Tom Foley in 94.
Suing the voters of Washington State for trying to put on term limits.
Exactly. And speaking of recounts, I mean, one of the attorneys working for on Lisa Murkowski's behalf is Ben Ginsburg, who worked for George W. Bush in Florida during that famous recount in 2000, for Norm Coleman in Minnesota in that unsuccessful recount.
So he's 50-50. What's your gut here? Don't you think that the federal court in Alaska is going to say, no, the Alaska State Secretary of State is empowered to decide the manner of election? As the Constitution says, the states shall decide the manner of elections. And if they think it's okay to spell Murkowski with a Y, so be it.
That would be Yurkowski, though.
I do understand. Okay, fine. In Minnesota, we're going to have a recount, perhaps much like we had with Al Franken and Norm Coleman. We're going to see a recount between Mark Dayton, who has a very narrow lead in that race, and Tom Emmer, the Republican nominee.
Right, but unlike the famous Norm Coleman, Al Franken recount when we were talking about 762 votes, Dayton has about a lead of about 8,700 votes.
So most people are expecting that to be a transition to a Democratic governorship, which would give the Democrats, by the way, 20 governorships, correct? That's not as low as many expected it to go. I think the general expectation was they were going to fall into the teens.
True, but a lot of the pickups were in states like Vermont and
small, you know, states,
small
Hawaii,
states.
They picked up Connecticut.
Exactly right.
California, another little one.
Well, that was big. But the Republicans did win the Pennsylvanias, the Ohios, the Wisconsins.
All around the Great Lakes.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Tremendous shift.
They
so from
Illinois.
From essentially a 60-40 split win the governorships for the Democrats 2 years ago to a 60-40 split
and we
for
still
the
have,
Republicans.
And we still have seven House races.
Seven
yet,
House
yet
races still out. So that's where the devastation really continues.
Right.
You've already got 240 Republicans in the House, 239, I believe, and we could add as many as seven more.
Well, perhaps five more, because of the seven, Republicans are leading in five. They've thus far picked up a net gain of 60 House seats from November 2nd. It could be 65. Right now, the two Democrats who are leading but haven't been called yet, Jerry McNerney in California 11 and
Jim Costa.
Jim Costa is losing. He's trailing, although they expect when the
But Jim Costa is in the very next district over.
Right. And actually, although he's trailing right now, when
and this is the guy who defeated Gary Condit a few years ago, for people's memory.
That's right, in 2002 in the primary.
Right?
Anyway, Costa is down by something like 134 votes, but they're still counting Fresno, and that's his base. Mm-hmm. So he could win. And also there's Ben Chandler in Kentucky's 6th District. He's up by a couple hundred votes, and he's likely to win as well. But here,
but the other five are leaning the other
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Tim Bishop and Dan Mafai in New York look like they're going down.
Texas 27 is still up. And, of course, Melissa Bean is also trailing in Illinois 8, the old Phil Crane district, and she may go down to defeat as well.
Still a couple of question marks then in terms of the leadership fights. One will not be the House Republican chair. The House Republican Conference chairmanship will go to Jeb Hensarling of Texas. He was the insider's choice, the choice of John Boehner, Eric Cantor, who are running the show over there. They chose Kevin McCarthy from California to be the new whip.
And good choice. He was the one who recruited all these candidates for 2010.
Yes, he is clearly the rising star in this group. And then Jeb Hensarling, because they need to get a Texan in there, among other things. And also because Jeb Hensarling has been one of their soldiers. So,
yes, but it's Jeb Hensarling instead of Michelle Bachmann, who's since dropped out of the race. But Michelle Bachmann, of all these people, was the Tea Party.
She was the only clear Tea Party person.
Right.
Well, she is the organizer of the Tea Party caucus in the House among Republicans. And she, of course, went out and campaigned for a lot of these folks. And, well, Michelle Bachmann was trying to make a point that, number one, there was no Tea Party person in the leadership. Number two, everybody in the leadership looks very much like a white male.
Right.
The committee chairs look like a collection of white males. Maybe it wouldn't be a terrible thing to get a little bit of gender diversity, at least, as the party starts to introduce a little bit more ethnic diversity as well.
But she's not going to go through the fight. I mean, she's dropped out of the race. So the Republican leadership seems set. And I guess the Democratic leadership is still up in the air,
yes,
at least for the number two position.
Well, no one is going to challenge Nancy Pelosi, who has a chance of beating her. There's a nominal challenge from Heath Shuler.
Right. And even though during the campaign there were many Democratic members, of course, many of them are no longer
that's
in
the
Congress.
Point. The point is that they will not be part of the 112th.
Right, right.
If you could take a vote among the people who were in the 111th, it might be a little closer. But I don't think there's a realistic chance of stopping Nancy Pelosi from being the leader. Now, whether or not that's a good idea for the Democratic Party is another question. What I would like to see is a vote, a no-confidence vote, an anonymous, you know, secret ballot. Let's all just decide, do we want to have Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the party for the next 2 years or not? And if she wins it, then more power to her. And if she loses it, then they can proceed to see whom they would like to have be the next leader with her out of the picture. But you can't run against the speaker without consequence.
Right.
That's why no one challenges a sitting speaker.
Mo Udall would do that as a quixotic kind of challenge from the liberal wing of the party.
But now the liberal wing of the party is the party.
Is the party, because most of the blue dogs are gone.
Or half at least of the blue dogs are gone, and most of the moderates are gone or in some sense or another in shell shock.
I also thought, though, that the New York Times editorial saying that Nancy Pelosi is not the right choice for the Democrats in the House. I thought that was a very interesting and surprising editorial coming from the Times.
I think that there are real divided feelings on the part of many liberals and Democrats. They are grateful to her for her leadership in the 111th Congress and for pushing through the Obama program as best she could. She would have had a public option. She would have had a more liberal approach to financial regulation. All of the complaints that have been made about the Democrats' failure to carry through on the spirit of 2008 cannot be laid at Nancy Pelosi's feet.
True, but if she pushed for those things, she would have lost all those blue dogs who were very instrumental in getting it passed in the first place.
She may not have been able to get as many votes from Democrats in the House, but her responsibility was fulfilled. And when health care looked like it might just not get done in the 111th, Nancy Pelosi stepped in and pushed it through, much more so than the Democrats in the Senate, and even, I would argue, much more effectively than the Democrats in the White House.
Perhaps.
So, if you believe in all those pieces of legislation, if you think those things were the right things to do in 2009 and 2010, then why would you punish her for having done it?
I agree with you completely, and that's why the Times editorial surprised me so much, although she has become the face of the opposition, the face of what's wrong with Washington.
Well, so you let the Republicans demonize anybody who is the leader of the Democratic Party in the House, and then you say they're no longer fit to be leader?
I don't think for a second that the New York Times got its marching orders from the Republicans who have been demonizing Nancy Pelosi. And for all the talk about Nancy Pelosi should step down as a Democratic leader in the House because of all these losses, John Boehner was a Republican leader in the House, the minority leader, in 2008 when they suffered double-digit losses and nobody, you know, was screaming for his head.
Well,
and
there were a couple
actually,
of people
who
did run against him. He had a much more legitimate challenge than Nancy's going to get. And there was a lot of feeling that it would be better if he just stepped aside and let a new generation come on. And I think there were a lot of people who expected him to move on after 2010, until, of course, 2010 turned into the shellacking, and he got a chance to be Speaker, and suddenly he was much more interested in staying. But that's kind of another story. The big focus now is what happens to the other two leaders on the House Democratic side.
Steny Hoyer, who had been the majority leader, but of course he could no longer be leader because Nancy Pelosi moves from Speaker to leader, so he would have to run for whip. But Jim Clyburn, African-American congressman, not an unimportant fact there, but he's the whip. So whom do the Democrats choose between Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn?
And that is a very tough question. Yeah. And of course, you know, Nancy Pelosi has created this situation by not retiring and saying, okay, I had my shot, I was Speaker. Now that I am no longer Speaker, there's no longer a place for me, I'm going to step away and let my number two and number three take over. That would have been one graceful way to exit.
Right.
That's what Dennis Hastert did. That's what Tom Foley did. Of course, he had been defeated for re-election in his own district, so he didn't have much choice. Instead, what she has done is she has created a situation where the remaining moderates in the Democratic caucus want to be with Steny Hoyer. The liberals prefer Jim Clyburn. And somebody's going to have to be dismissed in this thing. And there's no clear place to send either one of them to save face. So you're dividing the party at just the moment when you've been reduced to this much lower estate as the minority. And it just seems like the worst possible way to begin.
Bad timing. And the Congressional Black Caucus has already put down its marker. They say that they're clearly for Clyburn. Many Democrats I've spoken to feel that Hoyer would be a very effective leader in the opposition. I think everybody seems to agree that both Hoyer and Clyburn will have a leadership position somewhere. My guess is that Hoyer is whip. Now, remember, a few years ago, Nancy Pelosi backed Jack Murtha against Hoyer to be, you know, majority leader.
There's no love lost.
No, absolutely.
This is a personal thing. And I hope for the standpoint of the good of the Republic, certainly for the good of the Democratic Party, I hope that Nancy Pelosi's thinking as to why she is staying as the Democrats' leader is not overly influenced by her distaste at the thought of having Steny Hoyer succeed her.
I don't think it's that, but I agree with you. But I don't think it's that at all. But I do feel that if she's very smart, she stays out of this race. I mean, clearly she upset the Hoyer wing of the party, whatever that means, in backing Murtha. I think she stays away. What I suspect is that Hoyer becomes whip and Clyburn becomes the Democratic caucus chair. Some people may say that's a step down for Clyburn, but I think that's the way it's going to wind up.
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure about Hoyer. I think that he is personally more popular, but I also think that in addition to the Black caucus, it is overall, as a Democratic group in the House of Representatives, a more liberal group.
No question.
And they would be more comfortable with Clyburn and very uncomfortable with demoting Jim Clyburn. So it's going to be an interesting one to watch. It might be the most interesting thing to watch in the next week, because when they're coming back to vote as a new Congress on some of these leader fights, they're also coming back as the old Congress to deal with some leftover legislation.
In next week's lame duck session, exactly. And here it is, the Republicans saying that they swept the country on November 2nd. The American people have been heard. And yet, who's going to be running the show in the lame duck session? The Democrats, who ran the 111th Congress. So I kind of think there'll be a lot of pressure on a lot of folks to, look, you know, you vote for this kind of legislation at your peril, because the Tea Party folks will not stand for it.
And yet the Democrats have their last opportunity with their big majorities from the last Congress, this Congress still, to try to pass some legislation, to try to break off the high-end income earners from the extension of the tax cuts, maybe at $250,000 a year, maybe at $500,000 a year, maybe at $1 million a year, or maybe they capitulate and just give everybody the full tax cut from back in the Bush era and let that just remain on the books permanently.
Or they make the middle-class tax cuts permanent and they put a 1 or 2 or 3 year deal.
The Republicans say they won't accept that.
And Obama said he wouldn't accept a compromise either, but now it sounds like he's talking about a compromise. We also have Don't Ask, Don't Tell that may be on the table, the arms treaty with Russia.
Unemployment insurance. They've got to extend the benefits, or a lot of people who are still feeling the effects of the recession are going to lose their benefits.
Does raising the debt limit come up in the...
Not now. It won't come up until February.
And that'll
or March.
Be interesting, too.
That's a big issue coming on the horizon, and maybe the big first showdown of the 112th Congress. But that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for our own little lame duck session here on It's All Politics from NPR.
Whiskey, and I was a dying.